Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. So this episode of Southbound is a little different. It's a recording of a live event we did back on February 22nd at WFAE's Civic and Community Engagement Center in Uptown Charlotte. The topic was Charlotte's future, and our panelists are three people who have a lot of influence on what that future will be. Crystal Hill is the superintendent of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, one of the 20 largest school systems in America, with more than 140,000 students and 20,000 faculty and staff. Seal Gonzo is the founder of R-Bridge, which offers after-school programs to immigrant and refugee kids. Her group has served thousands of children from all over the world since 2013. And John Searby is executive director of both the Catawba Riverkeeper Organization and the Daniel Stowe Botanical Garden in Gaston County. The Riverkeeper Group is in charge of protecting a river basin that provides drinking water to 2.5 million people and power to nearly 4 million. If you enjoy this conversation, we're having another one this Thursday night, March 28th. This time around, our panelists will be Allison Craig, who helped craft the city's 2040 plan, Charisse Blackman of the Westside Land Trust, and Monique Douglas of the Brooklyn Arts Collective. Tickets and more info at wfae.org/charlotteforward. For now, this is what it was like when we gathered the first time around. Here's our conversation. I want to know about the most pressing issue facing the future of Charlotte in your area of expertise. And maybe we'll just start with Dr. Hill to begin with.
Sure. So, of course, being responsible for over 141,000 students, I joked with you earlier, I feel like I sleep pretty good at night, but things that I think a lot about, of course, is making sure that all of our students are prepared. You know, that it's a, we have a, so many students just wanting to make sure that they're prepared for their future. I think there's other things that kind of keep me awake at night that probably wouldn't be apparent to, like, normal people or, like, what's outside of just students. I think probably the larger operation. I don't think people understand that Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, of course, serves 141,000 students, but also a very large employer with 20,000 employees and all the underneath underground working that takes place. We're currently undergoing a huge modernization project, and whether or not that goes will be huge, not only for our district, but our entire community.
John?
For every environmental organization in the Charlotte region, the pace of development in this region is what is most concerning. The challenge that it really creates for our natural resources is not this the environment or development we have to choose. It's how are we thinking about development? Are we considering the environment in our development choices? Are we growing smartly? Are we growing sustainably? And right now, the thing that keeps me up at night is that our development community is moving a lot faster than our government agencies and our elected officials can, and we've got to get some of our policies and our regulations modernized so that we are not in a situation 10 years from now where we're wringing our hands saying, I wish we'd have done something 10 years ago.
Seal?
Yeah, along those nights, I think what keeps me up at night, oh, they told me that would happen. What keeps me up at night is sort of thinking in the future about what are we not doing now that we're going to regret in 10 to 15 years in supporting the newcomers and families that are arriving to live in our communities. So I feel like Charlotte and Mecklenburg, in the United States in general, you know, we are always talking about how innovative and how resilient and how much funding and economic mobility our families have, but we're not investing enough in the children during those first 2 years upon arrival. So I feel that we are, as a society, expecting all of our kids, who now are 30,151 in our school district that are learning to speak English, we're expecting so much of them without giving them enough support into their mental health, their emotional well-being, and overall supporting the family stability, which is what we need for the kids to actually thrive beyond academics.
For all of us, the quality of life here in Charlotte is so fantastic. It's such a draw. It is also almost our worst enemy.
Absolutely.
Because people want to live here. We all chose to live here because it's such a great place to live. But it's moving so fast that we're not keeping up. A lot of our policies in all of our areas are stuck in two decades ago.
Absolutely. That actually leads very nicely into my next question, which is, you know, this panel is not just about the future, it's about the future of this place. All of you are from somewhere else, as most people in this audience are, and most people in Charlotte are from somewhere else. Is there something about the culture of Charlotte that makes your job easier or more difficult? Maybe start on this end first, Sue?
Yes. Okay. Yes. So how many immigrants in the room? Raise your hands. One?
Yes.
Woo! Two? Three? Okay, we are a handful. So I feel like we need to understand that, you know, Charlotte, it's immigrant population, the foreign-born population in Charlotte has grown so much in the last, you know, to going back to the number of kids that are learning English at schools in the past 10, if since 2019, it grew for 10,000 kids. And the number of people just moving to Charlotte, it's just increasing. What I feel that we can do better as a community, the people that our neighbors support us, and the neighbors, you know, if you put a call out to come support the events, to advocate for our families, the people are there. What I feel like it would be easier is at the policy level. You know, I would love to see a greater level of support and protection for our families at the citywide level, at the county level. So to give you an example, in 2018, when we had the last series of raids of ICE in the community picking up people, and our kids were completely devastated and families were being separated, and it was happening across the state. Several cities across the state were writing letters, and our city did not participate in that. So to this point, I would love to see more advocacy for the safety, the protection of our kids and our families, especially the immigrant families that are undocumented.
Yes, so I absolutely love Mecklenburg County. And in terms of Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, I love that there are so many people that are really interested in the well-being of our students. There are so many nonprofits here, corporate, different government entities that all want to lean in and help. It's just wonderful. I've never been, you know, you listed all the places I've worked before. That's never been the case. So I think that is a huge blessing. I think it's also very difficult to manage.
Is it always a blessing?
It's a blessing, but it's also very difficult to manage. You know, because you have so many people that want to help, and everyone comes with their own idea of what we want to do to help you, what we want to do to help you. So trying to get all of that managed, and I think sometimes it's also very difficult because we have 184 schools. And so if you think about a business entity, we really have 184 franchises. So sometimes what happens is our schools get hit up with lots of different help. Everyone wants to help. And then principals and schools, just they're just so overwhelmed that they can't stay focused on what they're supposed to be focused on. So that's one of the things we're really working on, is how can we be strategic with all of the support that we have at the district level, being able to map out what the schools, what their needs are, what different partnerships, who wants to help who, so we can be much more strategic. So instead of the different organizations going to schools, they can come to us and we can help provide and roll out that support. And ultimately, all be working. I have a board member that always says rowing in the same direction. So if everyone wants to help, we just need to make sure that we're rowing in the same direction and singing from the same sheet of music.
The thing that makes work here in the environmental space a little more challenging than others is we don't have a real strong environmental ethos in this community. And if you look at other cities across the state, particularly Asheville and Raleigh, there is a citizen level expectation of environmental sensibility that permeates the community. Mm-hmm. If you look at our peers around the country, like Austin, Texas, and Portland, Oregon, that's exacerbated even more. And it what happens is that becomes a personal and a community value that gets applied as a pressure to elected officials and government agencies. The expectation that we're going to care for our natural resources comes from the bottom up. And so, like any good change, it starts at the bottom. And so not having that environmental ethos here in the Charlotte region can be a challenge, because we have a lot of competing interests in this region, some because we are a city of transplants. And so there is not a deep understanding and commitment to the history of this place. We see it in the buildings. Mm-hmm. This is maybe one of the older buildings in Uptown.
Ain't many more like it, yeah.
And you know, I heard a story, one of my staff told me a story earlier this week, that he was out on the 4 Mile Creek Greenway, and he overheard somebody saying, why is it called the 4 Mile Creek Greenway? The greenway is only a mile long, because it's 4 Mile Creek. It's the greenway on 4 Mile Creek. And 4 Mile Creek has a lot of history in this region. But if you don't know that history and why it's important, it's hard to love something that you don't understand.
I wonder how, and a couple of y'all's answers touched on this a little bit, sort of the sheer scale of growth and, you know, the multiplication of it in this community. Dr. Hill, obviously, you run one of the biggest school systems in the country, so I'm sure the immigration population here is getting bigger and bigger all the time. And John, your organization covers a huge amount of geographic territory and serves a lot of people. Are there advantages at all to working on that biggest scale, or do you wish sometimes that you could carve it down a little bit?
The goal for our bridge and the organization that I founded in 2014 is for it to be available to absolutely every child who's new to the United States. No, I'm not overwhelmed by the number of kids. We know that there are resources if we were all rowing in the same direction. I think that there are things that we can do. I mean, because there is benefit on having refugees and immigrants in Charlotte and in the country. I just think that we all need to understand that and just continue investing so that all kids can be supported and the families can reach stability and well-being.
The most meaningful action and advocacy that happens around protecting our natural resources is at the state level. Part of our motivation to grow and expand, we serve 26 counties in North and South Carolina. We have over 8,000 members across those 26 counties, is because the louder the voice we have in Raleigh and Columbia, the more work we can get done. The tipping point that is in sight but has not happened yet in the environmental movement in this region is regionalization of environmental work. We have regionalized almost everything in Charlotte. We work as a region on transportation issues. We work on economic development issues. We have started working on housing issues. We have a countywide school system. CPC is a regional entity as well. We have never approached environmental challenges as a region. And when we make that shift, there's going to be real change happen in this region to protect our environment.
What are the odds of that happening?
I would say, if you'd asked me that 3 years ago, coming right out of COVID, I'd have said very slim. The environmental, there's 10 kind of core environmental groups in the Charlotte region, and 8 of them have had new executive directors in the last 5 years. There's a different mindset now. And there's a mindset of we have to all be working together or we're not going to get things done. So I think there's a real possibility of that happening.
So here, what about the scale that you have to work on every day?
Yeah, so it can be very overwhelming, but as Sil just mentioned earlier, just the availability of resources. With us being so large and with such a large footprint in North Carolina, I look at it as we have a great opportunity to do something so great for so many students that can really have a major impact, not only here in our region, but across our state and the entire country. And of course, with our size comes availability of resources and partnerships like Central Piedmont Community College. I mean, amazing to have such a jewel right here in our backyard, to be able to partner with them and to provide opportunities to our students that in another region in North Carolina, you wouldn't have that opportunity. So with the size, you know, there's challenges, but I think there's also great resources. So just trying to think differently about that.
Yeah, speaking of that, as I was talking to all y'all beforehand to kind of prep for all this, Seal, maybe you told me that you actually have sent kids through John's organization to do events and that sort of thing. And I'm wondering, and I know y'all talked for a good while here beforehand, I wonder if you see like obvious connections between what you do and what the other panelists do. Anybody want to jump in on that?
You gave us a couple glasses of wine and an hour and put us in that room with Foundation for the Carolinas, we could probably come up with some pretty good programs.
Well, you know, somebody somebody in the audience mentioned that it's National Margarita Day, so we could try that. That would have made this whole event so much better. But yeah, so you do see connections there. Y'all do see.
We were talking before we got on stage about the experiential learning connection. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a value that CMS has in place. It's something that we use to try to connect kids with their water. We've exercised that with our bridge, and we've seen results, you know, where kids all of a sudden have an awareness of the fact that Irwin Creek that runs behind my house is the same water that comes out of my tap, you know, and that is really an amazing thing to watch a kid learn
the
that.
Same water that they go kayaking in.
That's right.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And Seal and Dr. Hill, obviously, y'all work with some of the same kids, right?
Absolutely. So in our case, with our bridge, we work, we started at the east side. We work with Windsor Park, Winterfield, Eastway. What happened really during COVID is like we had so many resources and support for families on the east side of Charlotte. And during COVID, we were in the neighborhoods and we found that people were driving or carpooling from the southwest area of Charlotte all the way to the east side to find masks, to access testing, to actually find information in other languages that wasn't Spanish and English. And something that is really important for me to everybody to hear. When you hear immigrants, I think that the first image that comes to your mind is the Latin American person. That is not at all true. So to give you an example, in our zip code in 28215, which is where Aldersgate is on the east side of town, we found on the 2020 census, 43% of the people living in that zip code do not speak Spanish or English. So it's about 12,000 people in that zip code that if you send a note home in Spanish, they will not understand it. So what we found is like, you know, there are areas and pockets in Charlotte that are growing in immigrant and refugees and newcomers arriving, but they're not finding information in their first language. So what we did because of COVID, we said, okay, so if we're going to expand our bridge, we need to figure it out how to do it at the school sites. And because, I mean, we had this beautiful center at Aldersgate that we lease for $1 a year, but it's just like a magical one thing at a time. So we reached out to Principal Pegram, and she suggested, you know, that we started a program at the school because Pinewood Elementary did not have an after-school program on site. And 70% of the kids at that school are newly arrived English language learners. So it was like this amazing symbiotic relationship where we can bring all of the resources to the entire family to help the kids after school, not just with their academics and homework, but also understanding why they're here, what just happened. A lot of our kids, you know, are still through that process of grieving, which is the separation from your home countries that all of us immigrants go through, and it's something that I learned as an adult. You know, your mind and your body process separation from your own culture and your loved ones in your home as we process grief. And we found that the kids cannot learn if they're grieving. And we know that the kids are being, you know, misbehaving, or many times they're labeled as trouble kids and they're being suspended or getting ISS. And really what's happening is they're misunderstood. So when we matched, when we partnered with Pinewood Elementary, and we work with 80 kids there, the results that we've had with those kids academically and socio-emotionally just skyrocketed because the kids are feeling safe and seen and processing. So I think that there's an excellent connection for outreach support the kids are in schools, because the schools cannot do it all. That is, no one can do it all. So we cannot do 100% of academic support, and we can complement what the schools are trying to do socio-emotionally to support the immigrant and refugee kids that are arriving.
No, I was just going to say, just to put it in perspective, we have over 30,000 students who are multilingual learners. Cabarrus County, which is right next door where I came from, The entire Cabarrus County school system is 30,000 students. So if you picked up Cabarrus County schools and dropped it in Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, that would represent the number of multilingual learners that we have.
One of y'all, and as part of those answers, mentioned something about COVID. And I was, not only are people still a little wary to go out, there's still lingering effects for people and all those sorts of things that make it sort of difficult to get people to come out for things. Thank all of you for coming out tonight. For the three of you in your jobs, are there lingering effects from the pandemic that you're still feeling? Dr. Hill, you're smiling. Is that a rueful smile?
No, sorry, I didn't mean to laugh out loud. But interesting that you say that in terms of effects. So I always told the story that how I ended up in Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools to begin with was I was trying to get out of public education. So I was...
You failed miserably.
Yes. I was chief academic officer in Cabarrus County Schools and had gone through COVID, and it was the absolute worst time in my entire career. It was nonstop, every day, changing the plan again, new directives. It was just a lot. I just chuckled because you said lingering effects that I was trying to get out of public education. Applied for probably 75 jobs, didn't get a hit on one of them outside of education. Somebody called me and said, "You think you're interested in CMS?" And I thought, "Not really, but but I'll do it. It's, you know, it's not in academics, so I'll try something out." And here I am today. So just a wild ride. But the reason why I chuckle is COVID was terrible. I think we are clearly seeing lingering effects from a social emotional aspect. We have students that are coming to us who have not had the level of socialization that, of course, normal human interaction. People have forgotten how to communicate with one another. And so the level of conflict between students, the level of conflict between students and adults, and then parents with employees, it's just been really difficult to manage. So just trying to get back to kindness and recognizing individuals as people, being really intentional in the way that we are setting up social interaction to reteach students how to engage with each other, how to resolve conflict and things like that. I'm definitely seeing lingering effects.
For us, you know, COVID was a before and after. Before COVID, we were an after-school program focused on English acquisition, social-emotional well-being, and cultural appreciation. We're huge on cultures and celebrating identities and our traditions. I think what COVID brought up is the massive gaps in support for families that, again, are newly arrived and that don't speak Spanish and English, specifically for, like, you know, culturally responsive healthcare access, like comprehensive healthcare access. We found that parents have never seen a dentist during COVID, and I was like, okay, that's interesting. So that's a gap that we'll put in the back pocket. We'll come back to that. And then, you know, just we realized that how important it is for people to have transportation. I mean, we opened up when schools closed down. We switched everything to food security in the neighborhoods. But when school came back up, it was like remote learning. So we opened our community centers at remote learning, but only the families that had transportation could come. And that was eye-opening to me, because the kids that should really be in a community center because they couldn't access internet at home because parents have never used a computer before, those are the kids that couldn't be there because we couldn't provide transportation anymore. So that really kind of shaped the whole other component of Outreach Now, which is family support. So I shared earlier today that we had one part-time family support person before COVID, and now we have a team of 11 people that speak 15 languages. And all of them do home visits and provide wraparound services and absolutely everything the family needs, including emergency funds for avoiding eviction and things like that. So, I mean, I think that COVID was really hard on the organization, but overall, I mean, really brought up a lot of gaps that we were able to now address.
For us, and probably for every environmental group in the country and the world, COVID was the best awareness campaign that we could have asked for, because people had no choice but to go outside. There was not, they could do nothing else other than sit at home or go for a walk outside. And a lot of them chose to walk along creeks for the first time in a long time, or go out on the lake for the first time in a long time, started to recognize that there was things in their backyard that they didn't even think about because they were busy going to movie theaters or shopping malls. And when that wasn't an option, it opened up a whole group of people that had never been spending out time outside by the water to become aware of our work.
The jobs that you three do, or the areas that you have expertise in, kind of come with their own baked-in controversies. And I'm wondering how each of you deal with people who not only might disagree with the decision you make, but sort of disagree with what you do on a fundamental level. You know, education, the environment, immigration, those are all sort of hot button topics, right? And there are people, I want to start with you, John, because it may be a little different in the sense that when we talk about climate change, there are people who don't believe it's real. And you probably have to listen to some of those people. I'm wondering how you deal with people who not only disagree with what you do, but kind of who you are.
So I deal with it in two ways. One, I ask them simply, how important is water in your day-to-day life? That usually cuts through partisanism pretty quick. Water quality is not a partisan issue. When it comes to the climate change question, the way we approach that as an organization is to talk about the effects of changing weather patterns. I'm not going to argue with you about whether you think climate change is real or not or what causes it. That's for other people to have a discussion about. Let's have a meaningful discussion about we have longer stretches of drought, we have more intense rainstorms, and the impacts that those have on our region. The reality of how many inches of water fall and how much period of time, that is not debatable. It happens at every house in this entire region at the same time. We try to put our conversations in places that are going to meet as many people as we can where it hits them the most. Am I going to have enough clean drinking water for me and my grandkids? Do the lights turn on when I flip the switch? Because all of our electricity, 98% of our electricity in this region relies on water. Am I going to be able to be okay with my kids walking down in the creek bed and going kayaking or going fishing or whatever they want to do from a recreation standpoint? Now, if we can talk about those things, generally we can get out of the politics of the environment of climate change and get to things that really matter here on the ground.
So you're well aware that there are a lot of people who wish some of the kids you help were not here. I'm not sure opportunity is the right word, but if you ever have to talk to those folks or people who are critical of our immigration or policy, how do you have those conversations, or do you?
Okay. I'm not nearly as composed as you are, that's for sure. Of course, I mean, immigration is not homeless, it's not hunger, it is a political issue. It is a very, very polarizing issue. The fact that I'm here, you know, it could be an issue. The way I try to lead the conversation is like, you know, from the very beginning of time, migration has existed, and humankind has moved towards resources, and that will not stop. It doesn't matter how many walls you put at the border. It doesn't matter how many awful, cruel policies. It doesn't matter if you keep separating families. That will not stop. So what I also like to say is that, you know, you look into all the numbers and the data and the impact in the economy and, you know, how much this country benefits from the immigrants that live here. You know, I don't know if you guys were at that presentation a few months ago where they said, you know, the economic impact of Latinos in the United States, and they were saying that we were like the fifth or the eighth economy of the world if we were our own country. And I was like, that's great. So what are you putting in to make sure that those people are actually living? And how much would that be if we actually paid what Latinos are worth? Because we are paid, what, 60%, 60 cents of a dollar or something? So, I mean, I like to take the conversation to every soul in this country benefits from immigrants being here. You know, I mean, I also like to, there's a lot of data that we can talk about and all the numbers, but fact is, anyone who will be in the situation of choosing their lives and the lives of their children may consider. I will promise you, if you were afraid of your life and your life of your children, you will at least consider picking up that child and start walking. Now, would you? We will never know, because you have to be extremely brave. So trying to change the way that people see immigrants beyond, you know, that burden into like, you know, these people are really brave and they're doing what anyone will do to save their lives and to save their children, to have a better future. So, I mean, I am way more passionate about the life aspect of it. I have a pet peeve when people start talking about resilience with immigrants. We can talk about it another time.
Go ahead. We're here.
It kills me. Resilience is not being, what we do is survival. You cannot tell me that waking up every day, not having a driver's license, not having insurance, not knowing if your child is going to be okay at school, not knowing if your husband is going to come back home because he must be deported, living in fear of the police, you know, not having access to resources, just living 20 years without being able to go back home, not knowing what your phone is going to be raining, you know, when you have a call from WhatsApp with something awful happening in your country and not knowing if you can go back. That is not resilience. That's survival. So I am tired of people saying that Latinos and immigrants are resilient, because we're not. We shouldn't have to be resilient. We just need to live in peace, justice, well-being, and just have a decent human life here. Because, I mean, the resources are here. Thank you.
Dr. Al, I've always thought that people think they're experts about two things. One, how to coach a local sports team, and two, how to educate their kids and everybody else's kids. The school board is one of those places where there doesn't seem to be a lack of people showing up in the meetings. How do you deal with folks who maybe think that not only are you making bad decisions, but they don't really believe in public education to begin with?
So I would say two things. Number one, public education is foundational for our society. And so what, you know, all parents have a choice to where, especially now, where they send their child to go to school. But at the end of the day, all children need to be educated. If it's not your child, it's your neighbor's child. The children that are being educated now in our community will be running our communities in the future. So it doesn't matter where you as a parent choose to send your child. All of us are going to either benefit or pay the price for not having a really strong public education in our country. So that would be thing one. Thing two is as far as political issues coming in the school. One thing that I have taken a really hard line with is that I refuse to allow our 141,000 students and 20,000 employees to be political footballs. I will not stand for it. All of the political mess, you know, I try to wade through, and I make decisions based on what I believe is in the best interest of children. And I think that's how I'm able to sleep at night.
When we come back, Crystal Hill talks about when she realized her work wasn't everything.
I thought to myself, self, you are replaceable.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to our recording of Southbound Live. These are stressful jobs, and you have staffs that have stressful jobs as well. I'm wondering, just kind of on a personal level, what y'all do to get through the day okay and wake up the next day and be ready to go again. Syl, you want to start there?
I would love to have a better answer.
Oh, that's okay.
I think that, you know, for about a year after COVID, I was really good at like self-care and go exercise and put down the computer. To be honest, right now with everything that may come in the near future, it's very hard to put things away. I'm constantly thinking about, okay, so what would happen if in different scenarios? if I have to say a couple of things that I do, I watch Binge Jobs with my daughter. Like, you know, we watched the Selena series like 4 times, and that's kind of like my healing space. I mean, that was a silly answer. I swear, it's just very hard. It's hard when you're part of the community. You know, you can say, I have the privilege to go back to home and to have a car and to speak English, but I mean, it's very hard to detach yourself from what you see every day to what you hear every day, because you keep hearing the news and it doesn't, there's not a lot of light on the other side yet. But again, I mean, that's also what keeps me going. You know, so it's, I'm sorry, I should have a better answer for that. But.
No, I think.
You sent me the answers and I couldn't even practice an answer for that. I couldn't think of anything.
I think there's a commonality amongst people who are passionate about what they do. People who don't have the opportunity to work in something that they're very passionate about have a hard time understanding the level of stress that you perceive is on us is not as great a weight as you might think, because we're doing something that we love every single day. I was way more stressed out working in corporate America, driving into Charlotte with a suit and tie on every morning, than I have been for the last 5 years leading two of the greatest environmental, you know, organizations in the Charlotte region, because I know that what I do on a day-to-day basis matters to 4 million people. I don't get stressed out when people are yelling at me or we're fighting at a city council meeting or whatever stressful thing might happen, because it just doesn't weigh on me that way. And I take my own advice. I say to people all the time, if you're tired of what you see in Uptown, go find a greenway to walk on. Come out to Daniel Stowe Botanical Garden. We got 380 acres you can explore. And so I try to do that myself. Like, get out, be quiet. Leave the phone in the office. Just allow nature to do its healing that it is amazingly good at.
I would agree with John. I am extremely passionate about what I do. Get up every day really excited to do the work. But I am a driver and a type A, go, 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 go type of person. I have really, though, worked hard with myself, with my team, to set boundaries. So one of the ways that I do that is I just have a saying, Saturdays are special, Sundays are sacred. So I try really hard. First of all, I've communicated that with the board, and they are amazing. Saturdays and Sundays, they don't bother me. I shouldn't say bother me, because they don't ever bother me. They don't reach out to me with questions or anything like that. So there's, you know, and if they do need to, they always say, I'm so sorry to call you on Saturday, but, you know, but those are very far and few between. And I try to exercise that same thing with my team. They need time and space. I think, you know, with our team, you know, they say, Crystal, you know, I really want to go to my child. This has only been a 4-hour week, and I think I've already worked 50 hours in 3 days, right? But, you know, they say, my child's basketball game. I always say, you know what? As much as I love my job, I learned a lesson early in my career. So let me just tell you what this lesson was. And it's really stuck with me. I was a teacher in Winston-Salem for Scythe County Schools and had a principal who wasn't a very nice person, but that's not the point of the story. It's when school started early. So we had started in August, you know, back in the day when we had the calendar started early. We started early and we went away for Labor Day. So we got an email that said, you have a staff meeting first thing in the morning, Tuesday morning after Labor Day. So we came into the meeting and everybody was crying. The principal had an aneurysm on Labor Day and passed away. That was in the morning. So everybody went through their day. Got an email that afternoon, another meeting in the media center, and Mr. Brandon, they said, this is Mr. Brandon, your new principal. I thought to myself, self, you are replaceable. Less than 24 hours of that man passing away, the replacement was there. That's one of the things that, as much as we love our job, we are just one person. Here today, gone tomorrow. And life has to be more than just about your work. It has to be about your family. It has to be about other interests that you have. And so you can pour your life into your career, into your as much passion, and, you know, these things really matter. You just really have to make sure that you're taking time for yourself and for your family.
Is there one particular project or something that you're working on now that gives you a lot of hope for the future in your area of expertise?
I mentioned earlier the fact that the major environmental groups in the Charlotte region are working together, collaborating at a very different level than we have in the past. And that is really giving me hope that we're going to accomplish great things. I think it's important that the community know who these groups are, because you may hear their names on a regular basis and not realize how interconnected they are. So Catawba Riverkeeper and Daniel Stowe Botanical Garden are the two organizations that I lead. Catawba Lands Conservancy and Carolina Thread Trail are a unified organization with two brands: Sustain Charlotte, Tree Charlotte, Clean Air NC, the North Carolina Wildlife Federation, the Carolina Raptor Center, and the Anne Springs Close Greenway. And that's not an exhaustive list of all the organizations that are working in the environment in the Charlotte region, but those 10 organizations' leadership teams are meeting together on a regular basis. We're talking about how we can find common ground, what things that we can work together on a regional basis. And so that gives me a lot of hope that we are improving this environmental ethos a little bit at a time. I'm hopeful that's going to have meaningful change in the next decade.
Yeah, so it's a really exciting time for me. Our board has just adopted new goals, so we're in the process of a new strategic plan. So I'm working on a lot of really exciting things. I think what I'm most excited about is driven down into what we refer to as goal four, and that's ensuring that when every student graduates from high school, they're either enrolled, enlisted, or employed. And so really excited about the partnerships that we're building to make sure that students have the opportunity to earn as many credits as they can while they're in high school for post-secondary work, that they're graduating with credentials, that they have a clear pathway. One of the things that we're lining up is really deep career exploration as early as elementary school and middle school. When students are mid-year eighth grade and they start registering for ninth grade, they have somewhat of an idea of what they want to do when they grow up, with a clear pathway on how to get there. A student's future should be so easy that when we get on an elevator, the bottom floor, and get to the top, we should be able to explain all the opportunities by the time we get to the top floor. To your point, you know, when you talk about how students have to navigate school, it is difficult for families to navigate school. I'm an educator. It's difficult for me as an educator to navigate school for my child, and I'm the superintendent. So imagine what it's like for a family that's not an educator, or a family whose parents don't speak English. We should make it really, really easy, because it's really not that hard. And so I'm just really excited about laying out those pathways so our students just have endless possibilities.
I am so excited about this that we're working on. So to your point, something that we noticed, again, during COVID, it's like there were like three major gaps in services accessible for families. So one of them was accessible, non-faith-based, culturally responsive, comprehensive healthcare. The other one was access to pro bono representation for immigrants that are in deportation proceedings, or immigrants, you know, seeking asylum. And the other one is the wraparound services support for families to actually learn how to navigate all of the systems, the school system, transportation, DHS, I mean, everything, right? Everything's new, everything's in a new language. And we figure that families, when they enroll their kids to school, sometimes they had to take 2 or 3 days because they're always missing paperwork. So, I mean, enrolling the kids to school, it is a complex process. So we want to make it easier. So we knew wraparound support, pro bono representation for immigrant families, and comprehensive healthcare. So I went to Aldersgate back in 2021. That leases our community center right now for $1 a year. So I went to Aldersgate and said, hey, in a jokey way, if you have another building laying around somewhere, let me know, because I'd love to do a one-stop shop for immigrants. 3 months later, they call and says, hey, Sil, I mean, we have half a building. It's about 5,800 square feet. It's upside down. Like, somebody closed the door in 1960, never opened it again. So do you still want it? And I said, absolutely. And this was 3 years ago. Of course, I mean, we don't do healthcare and we don't do immigration law. So I picked up the phone and called two amazing women that lead two incredible organizations that are mission aligned to our bridge. One is Charlotte Community Health Clinic with Carolyn Allison. And the other one is Stephanie Arteaga with Comunidad Colectiva and Carolina Market Network. And we got together into a meeting, and I said, would you like to start this project with me? And 3 years later, we are about to open a building that is going to be so welcoming and inclusive with, you know, staff speaking 15 languages, that is going to be called Charlotte's Home. I am so excited. So we're about to break ground on March 8th, and we should be able to move in by the fall.
What's something in y'all's areas of expertise that just regular folks could do to help you guys reach your goals?
When you hear something bad about Charlotte Mecklenburg schools, don't always believe what you see on the news. Mm-hmm.
As a member of the news, I'm going to pass it along to John, what would you like to say?
I would say make sure your elected officials and your municipal and county staff know what you care about and what is important to you, whether it's the environment, whether it's taking care of immigrant population, whether it's funding our schools at a high level. Don't keep your mouth shut about the things that matter to you. The political climate that we live in today, there's one really positive thing about it. It doesn't take very many loud voices to move the needle if people have the courage to speak up about the things they care about. I want you to speak up about how much you care about the environment and that you want your elected officials thinking about it when they're making policy. That's my, with my professional hat on. With my personal hat on, I want you to also talk to them about immigration reform. I want you to talk to them about funding our schools at a high level, because they will listen. But if we just sit here on our hands, then you know, we have no room to complain.
So,
same as what John said. I mean, it's tough. We don't know what's going to happen later this year. Just don't stay, you know, feeling bad about what's going on. Don't just complain on Facebook or social media. Actually pick up the phone, go to the meetings and speak up about what you care the most.
Can I have a do-over?
You can have an addendum if you like, sure.
Sorry, that was just a thought that was running across my head. But seriously, one thing that I would like people to do, going back to making sure that we're supporting public education, you mentioned funding for public schools. I think one of the most important things that we need to do as a state is advocate for teacher pay. The average or the beginning teacher pay and the average teacher pay in this state is not a livable wage. It's absolutely terrible. The only way that we have to influence teacher pay in our county is our county partners, the Board of County Commissioners, who have been extremely supportive in the support of providing a teacher supplement. They gave an increase last year, and I know that they're committed to increasing teacher pay with the supplement, but that is on top of which should be the bare base pay of teacher pay. And there, we can do something about it tomorrow. So I would definitely advocate for that.
Right. So just one more reminder. If you enjoyed this conversation, we're doing another one Thursday night, March 28th at WFAE's building uptown. Tickets and more info at WFAE.org/Charlotte Forward. Forward. That's the direction we've always been pointed in this town. Charlotte has not spent a lot of time looking in the rearview mirror. We don't have a lot of old buildings because we tore them down to build new ones. We have grown like kudzu without a whole lot of reflection on what that growth means. You heard our panelists talk about how that's one of the big problems facing Charlotte, that everything happens on a larger and faster scale. It's exhausting just trying to keep up. But what I hope you also heard is optimism that we're capable of doing it. We can create environmental rules that make sense. We can take care of our newcomers who are immigrants and refugees. We can give everybody a solid education in our public schools. Those are challenging goals, and we're all going to have to pull together to meet them. But part of what makes Charlotte an interesting place to live is that we haven't given up. This is still a place of possibility. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Lisa Wharf and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR One app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound at our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.